KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law School, who is working on a project with Gerard Magliocca of Indiana Law, who is not joining us today, involving 3D printing. The working title of an article that they are currently writing is called The Disruptive Power of Three-Dimensional Printing. Three-dimensional printing is one of these technologies that if you're going to define disruptive, 3D printing would seem to be it. In the last, I'd say, year, maybe two at most, there's been increasing focus, although it's still slow, on the world of 3D printing, the notion, and it's more than a notion now because it is a reality, that one could take an object and copy it at home. Copy it without having an assembly line, copying it without having engineers, copying it basically with what is, and we'll talk to Devin in more detail about this shortly, a souped-up Xerox machine, except you're not Xeroxing paper, and you're not using ink, and you're not taking pictures, but rather you are Xeroxing a hammer. Or, as we'll talk about today, you're Xeroxing pharmaceuticals, or you're Xeroxing, and I'm using this generic term that used to be trademarked but no longer is, you're Xeroxing meat, you're Xeroxing organs, or most controversially in the, and I think the touchstone of this issue as it enters public discussion, you're Xeroxing guns. So Devin and Gerard are working on this project where we're going to be discussing a wide range of issues involving 3D printing, aside from defining what it is and what its limitations are and where it's going. We're going to be focusing in the second half of the show primarily specifically on patent law and how patents are going to be challenged, according to Devin and Gerard, by the coming 3D wave, just as copyright law has been challenged by the internet itself. As you know, listening to Hearsay Culture, and as many people know, just paying attention to the internet, probably the hottest, most controversial issue involving the internet itself is the rampant copyright infringement or piracy alleged by anyone that makes any content that might be copyrighted. And that issue arose over the last 15 to 20 years as it became increasingly easy and then almost cost-free for one to simply copy another copyrighted work. That issue has gone through many permutations in the last 20 years. There have been efforts to change the law. There have been efforts to change the code. There have been efforts to try to fix the variety of things that might make it more difficult to make copying or do copying. You could increase penalties and so forth. All of these issues have led to where we are today, where piracy or copyright infringement, depending on your perspective, still exists, and yet we still have not come up with a great solution that balances the interests of copyright owners against the general interests of the public to have access to information, the interests of others to build upon previous works and do things like fair uses and so forth. Patents now appear to be on the precipice of going through that same challenge, both from a regulatory perspective and a practical perspective, and it appears, according to Gerard and Devin, that 3D printing will be the touchstone to go through that challenge. So, we are going to have what I think is a very timely and very interesting discussion with Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law School today on Hearsay Culture. By way of brief background, he's an associate professor of law, having graduated from Yale Law and Berkeley. He was also the first academic research counsel at Google. I've known Devin for now several years, having met him at an intellectual property scholars conference years ago, and we've come across each other from time to time, and I've been a fan of his work for several years, and so I'm excited to have him on today. He's published in a variety of law reviews, including Georgetown in Florida and Wisconsin, and others, and he is joining us via Skype from his home in San Diego. We're recording on July 15th for airing on either July 17th or July 24th. So, without any further introduction, Devin, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
So let's start off, Devin, with a question that I ask most of my authors, and I'll ask you this. So tell us more about your background and how you got into the issue of 3D printing before we define what it is.
Oh, wow. Well, so I'm old enough to remember when IP was starting to become a hotter topic while I was in law school, and I frankly did not do and didn't focus much on patents. I was more interested in trademark, and I did early domain name litigation. Some of the I was on the Lockheed VNSI case, so the first some of the first shots across the bow, as it were, about contributory and vicarious liability, and just stuck with the tech world for quite some time and did a couple other things before coming back to being a law an academic. And then the last few years were really kind of great. I had a year at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy with Ed Felton and his crew, where I picked up, I think, a decent amount about the interface between technology perspectives and engineering perspectives on policy. And then sometimes I would say, you know, then the law doesn't really work the way you guys thought. So that was really nice, and that helped bridge over to my 2 years at Google. And while I was at Google, the 3D printing stuff, you know, people across the country may not be hearing about it as much, but it's getting there. But in Silicon Valley, that sort of thing becomes front and center. And I was looking at it, and I thought, well, wait a minute. This really starts to look like the part of the law that I most care about, which is, when is there a technology and a business practice that coming forward, about to hit the marketplace in a way that will really, really mess with some of the core assumptions behind IP law? And what's fun to me about that is, having done work with startup companies and Fortune 500s, looking at the assumptions from the business side as well as the law side about, oh, well, that's what patent does, and of course it works, and then realizing almost from Michael Porter's sort of simple but just so useful insights about competitive strategy that there's always something that can come along and just smack something kind of upside the head and say, oh, really? We're going to go do this now. And it can undermine not only a whole business sector or change it, but at the same time, the law has to figure out what to do with that. And sometimes there are demands made on the law. So for me, 3D printing just popped up, and I saw this great intersection between really interesting technology starting to become very much at scale, which is where the Google piece came in. When things start to go beyond just B2B or business to business and really start to hit that consumer level, I think we've seen that pattern with copyright and other areas where intellectual property, one of my claims is, it's much better suited to corporations. It's much better suited to business to business. And every time we scale it, it just messes with the system in a way where everyone runs for the hills and says that there's theft and that the world will stop spinning, and we need to figure out, well, what exactly is happening.
So Devin, let's get right into this issue, because it's one, like I said, that's getting increasing attention in the mainstream media, but I think we're still trying to think through its basic implications. So I gave my kind of cursory definition of 3D printing, but I want your more scholarly and detailed definition. What is it?
Okay, so with all apologies to the engineers who know this much better than I, here's what how I understand 3D printing. There's a whole world out there that has been around for some time, and it's called computer numeric control devices, or CNC. And this is not just 3D printing. A lot of this is really high-end laser cutting machines and lathes and things like this. But the costs of those and the trickiness of those have been fairly high for a while. So sort of like mainframe computers, what was going on in this space with the early 3D printers as well were very large machines that cost a fair amount of money. And you would take design software and you could create something and it would print a really nice prototype. Now, the difference between the cutting away process and the 3D process is important. In 3D printing, what you've got is layer by layer, you are adding as opposed to subtracting from something. So one thing that Gerard and I use in the paper is, The claim is, Michelangelo said all he did was subtract from the marble to see what was trapped within. 3D printing is the opposite of that. That is, you feed in the design pattern, and the machine then will make it, and it can do incredible things. And because of the additive process, as I understand it, it can do certain fine-grained detail that cannot be done as well from a subtractive process. Now, at the big scale then, what was really fascinating about some of these things was you needed to know how to use a computer-aided design or CAD program, and it was a fairly sophisticated device. What's happening now and what got me more interested in the 3D printing that I think what you're asking me to explain a little bit is, well, why does that matter for everyone today? Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is very similar to, all right, with Steve Jobs having died recently and sort of a reconnection to the early 80s and the garage culture of Silicon Valley, that's what's happening here. These are hobbyists who have had a very nice moment where the hardware itself is dropping in price like crazy. So whereas these machines, like the early mainframe computers, used to cost thousands upon thousands of dollars, every day this stuff is coming down in price to the point where you can get a pretty good one for about $4,000 or $5,000. And there's even now a commercial grade one that Staples has just started to sell for about $1,300, I think it is, maybe a little more than that. And they're continually improving the hardware so that that comes home. Hardware alone, to stay with that for a moment, it also is a very open source based movement, which means people are swapping ideas, sharing the ways to make it, and really expanding out the ability for this, just the hardware, to come into the home.
So we're talking about the ability to take an object and copy it in a way that makes it usable, correct? I mean, to be clear about this, it's not just a representation or a model, but something that is, in fact, functional.
Well, so that's a great question. There's a couple things going on. First, on the design side, the reason this stuff is becoming fascinating is, as I said, normally you need a computer-aided design program. But as I like to put it, when the unfrozen caveman lawyer like me can do it, you have to be a little bit more wondering, well, what's next? Because you or I could take a camera or, well, first there's scanners that, to your point, let's suppose you built the proverbial better mousetrap. We could do an electronic scan of it and get a very good file. We might have to clean it up a little bit and print that widget, that better mousetrap. Or you could take a digital camera, and if you're patient and take, say, 20 or 30 pictures from a whole bunch of angles, likewise, it could be uploaded for free, by the way, on 123D is the software, I think. And then downloaded, and with other open source software, one called Blender, we again would have to massage the file a little, but then print a very good copy. Maybe not 100% replica, but very good. And for our purposes, it could probably get whatever might be patented correct. And the next question I think is implied in what you're saying is, well, how useful? How much could you do with that? Mm-hmm. And that's where the material science is getting fascinating. Right now, mainly the way 3D printers work is they are using heat and plastic. So the plastics are getting better, but, you know, could it handle some of the material science aspects of that? Could it really handle the stress of something that may have been originally in a metal or other things? Not clear. I think that's wide open and where there's also amazing things happening. One of the things that's come up, though, is there are now 3D printers that can, in fact, print metal at room temperature. There are 3D printers that can do living cells and tissues. There are 3D printers where they did cake frosting, which I assume was just for the fun of it. And there's a couple scientists out in Scotland, if I remember correctly, who have figured out how to take 3D printing and start to maybe be able to compound chemicals. So a way to back into your question, well, how practically useful is it? I would say the home one, it's not fully there, but it's moving so fast that I keep seeing new articles about a new specialized printer that's doing ceramics or doing metal. And what's coming is the ability then to make something that's pretty strong and could be quite useful. It may not be an exact replica of the original, but, you know, for a lot of people's purposes, it could be just fine. And then if you think about toys, you think about a whole bunch of things that are, in fact, out of plastic, well, that those industries are going to be looking at the current state of the art and saying, well, wait a minute, we usually use that, and I know this is true, for their high-end prototyping. So if it's the true prototype and now you can do it at home, that could be, in fact, quite 100% useful copy.
So we're chatting with Professor Devin Desai on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. All right, Devin, I want to ask you the reaches of 3D printing's capability now before we get into what it's really doing today and the challenges we have with guns and drug paraphernalia and so forth. So you quickly said living organisms can be copied. So I want to be clear about what exactly this means or how specific we're talking. Let me take a hypothetical. I put my hand onto the glass or printing plate or whatever it is that I need to do to have my hand copied. And going through the 3D printer, what comes out is a hand, right, that can be attached to a human body, correct?
Not exactly.
That's why I'm asking, because I want to be clear about what we can do. Okay, so now what's wrong? So, what's wrong about what I just said?
Okay, so step one, a version of what you said is true, which is there are some fun things. I think it's in New York now near MakerBot, where if you remember those old photo booths where you could get the strip of four pictures and you make your goofy faces, I think they've purposely adapted one of those booths to get that feel. So that you could take a picture of your hand or, in fact, your head, and they'll print a very good plastic copy of your head. What's happening at the science front, really not at the consumer front, is that there are people who are figuring out how to use 3D printing, and I frankly don't understand the science behind this completely yet, but the news reports and some of the articles indicate that they can then use this to come up with, say, skin tissue, for instance. And there's people who are trying to use this so that I don't know if it's happened yet, but the goal would be, imagine someone who's wounded in an emergency situation here or in war, and you had a 3D printer that could actually print a viable skin graft as opposed to waiting to get one. For field work, this would be incredible. I believe there have been things that model certain other tissues, maybe cartilage, and I think I saw liver cells. But no, it's not yet the replicator to the point where you just sort of stick it in there, you get a sense of what you want, and then out comes the actual tissues. This is a slightly different application of the technology, which is what makes the technology, I think, a little confusing as well, is that it's not yet Star Trek replicator magic, but at times it feels like there's so many things happening at the hardware, the material, and the software level that, boy, isn't it there yet? And as you nicely pointed out, not entirely.
Mm-hmm. And so so it's important that, of course, thinking about the frontiers of these issues, is generally a good idea to do as far in advance as possible, so long as you were able to have a real sense of what those frontiers might be. So when we say I'm gonna go to guns in a moment, but when we say living organisms or living things, what are we talking? We're obviously talking about, I think, synthetics, right? I mean, we're not talking about taking, the materials part of it being cells and reconfiguring those cells, are we?
No. I believe it is, in fact, it's cells. We're talking about a world where, if you're familiar with sort of one of our other friends, Professor Andrew Torrance's work, mm-hmm. the synthetic biology world is very interested in this technology, and there's some people who are trying to adapt it over to in fact deal with the nanoscale. And these are cells. This is tissue. This is not. It's synthetic in the sense that it's I guess human made, or there's an intervention by a human. But I don't believe it's inorganic. Mm-hmm. If that's what you're asking.
And so let me ask one last of these frontier-type questions before we get to what's actually happening now, perhaps even in people's homes. Pharmaceuticals is something else that you mentioned, or you discussed it in the article, which I should mention, is in draft form, and so, Disruptive Power of Three-Dimensional Printing is the working title, but, this article in its final form may be something else. Give the listeners an idea of what that means. So, I'm not speaking for myself personally, but I take a heart medication, and that heart medication is patented, and so it's going to cost a lot more because it's under patent. I can, again, I'm posing this as the hypothetical, I can take that patented medication, put it in my home 3D printer, come up with my version of a generic, and treat myself and not have to pay another dime. Now, put aside the patent aspect of it for a moment, because we'll get to that later. Is that an accurate description of what's possible?
You know, let's back up, because I think even when you, with the, when you introduce the idea, the Xerox printer is really not the way to think about 3D printing. Let's back up a little.
Okay.
At one level, right, it's a printer, and in fact, it's totally normal to think of it as more of like a Xerox machine or a laser printer, because in fact, the guts of the printer are based on expired patents from laser printers, the things that we all have become quite comfortable with, and, you know, you have the PC low letter moment, perhaps, if you remember Office Space, but that basic technology is at play. However, the difference here is think of it more like a personal computer for things. So when we have a PC, it's a fairly general computing device, and we plug in software, give it instructions, and out come web pages or printed pages or other designs and things like that. Now we're taking that and going three-dimensional. So the printer itself is not doing the copying. The copying comes from either a scanner or someone else who takes a file, the software, and gives it instructions to do X, Y, or Z. So back to your pharmaceutical question. The fact that these two scientists have got a breakthrough at being able to use this technology to manipulate compounds and create perhaps pharmaceuticals out of it means this. If someone has that device and it gets to the point where it can do that well, they still need to have, in some ways, your area, either the if it's a trade secret for the compound or if it's a actually here's the how-to of the chemicals, they need to then take that, turn that into the right software, and plug it into this printer to make it. Right, so there's a couple steps in between, which is why it's important to understand that chain within the sort of supply chain of 3D printers, if you will, because the printers themselves aren't doing that copying. They aren't doing the design. They are the thing that has the output. It's a slightly dumb box in that sense, not entirely, but that might be one way to think about it. Then there's the OS for that, and then there's the actual software telling it what to do. And so with the pharmaceuticals, or for instance, Craig Venter's group that's trying to come up with a 3D printer and using DNA so that they could actually print an on-demand vaccine, it's not at the point yet where you quickly scan it and all of a sudden can do it. But if you have all the different pieces of the puzzle, you have either the ability to scan it or somehow in your example, let's say you had something that could, I don't know, pulverize, I'm making this up, the pill, figure out its constituent parts and how to actually compound it, yes, in theory, in about 10, maybe 20 years, these breakthroughs could allow that printer to print that on demand. Now, there's some other aspects to this, right? How often are you or I going to have the appropriate chemicals to actually get that thing working? I'm going to guess not that often.
And that's where, and that's what we're going to talk about shortly, which is how you regulate some of the potential harms or downsides to having this technology exist without, of course, killing the technology itself, which is something we'll talk about as well. We're chatting with Professor Devin Desai on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Devin, so let's get down to what, and it's amazing to say this, what is comparatively mundane or a comparatively mundane example of 3D printing compared to what we just talked about, which is the copying of guns. I mean, at least from my perspective, that seems to be the prototype example, if you will, that's now being discussed, even to the extent that there's discussion of regulation, which we'll talk about too. So, but give our listeners a sense of that. What is the status of the ability of, again, and I do want to focus on this home aspect of it as opposed to industrial uses, the home ability of an individual to copy a gun?
Yeah, I think the gun question brings home the power of 3D printing in a really clean way. And if you think about it, guns are mass produced. It's a major industry. People can love them or hate them, but they're there. And there are patents behind it, right? And so kind of where you started, which was, well, how easily can I copy that? And the answer is maybe you or I wouldn't be great at copying it, but we could start to. We could start to learn to take the pictures and come up with the designs. But what's happened is a little over a year ago, when these hobbyists used their 3D printer to make the part of the AR-15, the lower, as I believe what it's called, that is regulated by the government, it was fascinating to see how that played out, because they figured out the design and on one hand, people said, oh, it's not a big deal. It only handled a few shots. Of course, a few other people said, wait a minute, it still handled a few shots. And the same thing would be true of perhaps a fully plastic gun. So the two angles on this would be, one, perhaps you or I could figure out how to make our own fully plastic gun, for the not to scare people. And I think it, but if you remember, I think it was the movie In the Line of Fire, John Malkovich's character, that's precisely what he builds on his own with plastic molding. So the question is, does that become even easier for anyone to do? And the answer is perhaps. But then, in addition, what makes this most interesting is, these guys shared their plans online. So even if you and I weren't that great, we kept trying and thought, we're just bad at this. But someone else could say, oh, well, hey, guys, just take our file and plug that into your printer and you're good to go and use this plastic. We could print like crazy. Now, what happened even more interesting was perhaps because of the press, I don't know, the folks who did it the first time through, a little over a year later, with a fair amount of testing and probably some hard work, came up with a new print of the receiver. And according to their video and the news reports, the only thing that stopped them firing this time, as opposed to it cracking after a few shots, was that they ran out of ammo after having fired 600 rounds. Now, they can again share that everywhere. But part of, I think, the reason they were able to answer their questions about design and the stresses of the plastic and whatever other issues came up with the engineering of the receiver was 3D printing has great potential regardless of the gun industry, because there's a lot of rapid prototyping you can do. In the old days, if we wanted to do that, we'd have to get the metal. And by the way, what a lot of listeners may not know, as far as I can tell, it is completely legal for anyone to make the parts and assemble a gun in their house if they have a lathe and all the metal working, et cetera, that is needed to do that. And that's what these guys were doing, but they can move much more quickly, which is that sort of internet moment. It just is it's almost as if it's tumbling over itself faster and faster, right? It's a slightly snowball-y effect in that sense, because either on their own now, they can continually test and fail, right? Iteration after iteration until they get it right. Or they do that as well as embracing the open source movement, share all that stuff. So you have not only two people, but maybe 20 or 30 people who decide, let's keep doing this, and they keep swapping. So the knowledge base, in a way that we tend to normally like, right? In that Silicon Valley, let's create, let's move forward with technology way, that's happening. It's just now it's being revealed to work in a sector where some people would say, I'm not so comfortable with that.
You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. As you know, if you listen to the show, KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can listen to the show, and you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you keep listening. So to get into only one quick weed question here, and then I really do want to turn to the focus of your article in its current form, which is you know how patent law and then you know more broadly the law should react to all this. One interesting note here, and again it gets to what is really possible. You note in the draft that even if you could copy a gun, and I'm using these vague terms, but just copy something that would fire a bullet, and even if you could copy a bullet, you'd still need gunpowder. And that gunpowder may not be, or at least as it stands now, may not be something that one could copy or one could quote-unquote print. What's the difference? Why is it that gunpowder, for example, is something that is more challenging to copy or print versus a bullet or the gun itself?
It's a great question. And, you know, in some ways, it is a draft, and the beauty of sharing it with Dave is I have to retweak that, because as we've already been talking about, if I can have technologies that are doing vaccines and chemical compounding, there's probably a way to use 3D printing to make gunpowder. Mm-hmm. Whether it's there yet isn't clear, but right now I think it's a combination of the chemical side of 3D printing is not as advanced as some of the other aspects of 3D printing, mainly the plastics and the metals. But yes, I think if part of what you're asking is, isn't it possible that they could start to have a 3D printer that somehow prints gunpowder? I think the answer to that is actually going to be yes. The irony of that might be that what is normally a process of finely powdered, or one of the methods of 3D printing is finely powdered substance A that is like toner in that gritty sort of thin sense, and then the laser, in fact, sints it, heats it to a high level and makes it set into its new form, would somehow now be a process of take different powders and turn them into one big pile of new powder. So it's a great question. They could get there. They're not there yet. The hard part then becomes, I think, something you wanted to talk about in a little bit, which mm-hmm. is, well, could you regulate the different materials that are being used for different purposes? And we'll get to that when the conversation moves that way.
Yeah, and we're going to head there in a sec, because that's where, you know, I think that's the touchstone issue, right? Is as I read through your draft, in theory, there's nothing that shouldn't be copyable, right, at some point. And yet the real issue, at least I think the regulatory challenge, is not that the technology exists to make copies, but that anyone could have access to the technology which would allow you to make copies. And so just as we're going to talk about, just as copyright law focused 20 years ago, or starting about 20 years ago, with the notion that, wait a minute, you don't need a recording studio, you don't need a machinery to make a copy, you don't even need a cassette tape, now you need a button and a computer. So too, it seems like now the patent industry, as it were, is going to face that. So let's turn in that direction. And as we focus now a bit on patent law, Devin, I will just very quickly ask you, and I do this even though we discuss patents regularly on the show, but I don't want people turning off your say culture once they hear the word patent, because they think they don't know what it means. So give us, if you will, the 30-second definition of what a patent is.
All right. Before we do that, I want to just make sure the listeners understand one thing. It's better to think of this not as copying, but as making, right?
Okay.
It has the potential to be copying, but most people, I think, sort of like with copying in copyright, would say, yeah, at one level, I copied certain music, and that's a possibility. But here, much of what's happening with 3D printers is making things and tweaking things and tinkering with things. So automotive, other areas. While there is some possibility for pure copying, which is why the patent stuff comes in, there's that extra layer here of a lot of work to make it happen. So the patent itself,
let me stop there for a second, because that's an interesting point. So because I think it's a fair one, and one that I maybe want to flesh out a little bit. So you know, as far as the law goes, right, the big concern from an intellectual property perspective is going to be the question of copying. But what you're describing in terms of making, I think I hear you saying that you're talking about making improvements on existing things that might be patented. And if that's the case, I think maybe I should ask you this question, because what you hear around this is the notion and this name, the maker movement. So let's dig there a moment, because I think it's important. Is there a difference in your view in terms of how the law should react to 3D printing when we're focusing on copying something that already exists, and by copying I'm now going to define it to mean you make no changes at all, versus making, where you're, as you said, you're tweaking or changing or in some way creating something which has not previously existed, or at least to your knowledge, hasn't previously existed? Should the law view 3D printing differently based upon that?
Yes.
Okay, and why?
And here's why. This is why I've been trying to really hope that people get the idea that 3D printing itself is a personal computer for things. It is a general purpose device. And the law normally has been good about letting us have those devices. So when people say, oh, but you could copy, right? We could, as you pointed out, we could use a PC or a Mac or some sort of computing device to copy, but we didn't shut down the entire ability of the device. That's not what we're trying to do when we balance, right, in the patent law or copyright context. And so people understanding better that this is something that is incredibly open, right? The box itself is open source for the most part, and even if it isn't, it's programmable, it can do many things, and many times it's being used simply for rapid prototyping, coming up with new things. Could be homemade jewelry, it could be customized things that you just can't get at Walmart. In a world, if some of the listeners are familiar with the website Etsy, which is all about connecting as a marketplace, really interesting customized craftspeople to people who want to spend a little more or commission an object, 3D printing fits right in there. So when people start to talk about, but it has the potential to also have this problem for pure copying or things that patent law presents as a problem, the answer to that is it does have that potential, but many things that are general purpose devices have that potential. And shutting it down in the name of these sort of important but probably edge or fringe-like aspects of the technology is not wise. And this might help. Tell me if you want me to pause for a moment, get to your – you know, I don't think I can define patents in 30 seconds, but – let's think of it this way. The patent system, as I understand it, is really this interesting way of an exchange, right? You get your patent, which gives you exclusive rights to make, use, and sell your invention. And there's a certain limited time here. But there's also, as part of that, that's what you get. But what also happens, right, is you have to disclose the data needed to make the invention so that other people can make and use it. And there's this tempered response between each other. Now, there's, as probably the people listening, certainly in the Bay Area, but maybe even nationwide now, no, patents have been a complete mess according to some. There's some fascinating work going on about, do they make sense for software? Do they make sense for other things? There's the cell phone issues. And those are all going to be there, and they're even cropping up already with the hardware of 3D printing. But when you ask, you know, what are we doing with patents, that's the core, right? There's, I get a special term, 20 years, to exploit this patent as I want. And in general, the public is supposed to have a greater store of information that allows it to learn, to improve, to tinker. And in the interesting thing is, and what drew me back to 3D printing in that sense was, the core concept was, right, cough it up. Given your work on trade secrets, right, this is a different version. This is give up the idea and the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there haven't been crippling rates of infringement, but there, of course, has been infringement. And there's enforcement costs, right? I'm not going to pretend that that's not a big part of all this. And I think part of what was happening was, again, infringement at scale, like in copyright, costs more or used to cost more. And 3D printing raises the possibility that, well, you know, maybe infringement at scale for simpler things is now on the horizon. And so the market might have to shift just as it did with copyright. Whether that's going to be as much the case for pharmaceuticals and the places where the upfront capital cost is really big, you know, that remains to be seen. That might take another 15 to 20 years, or it might be that the sophistication of that 3D printer, why would you or I really want to spend, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 even for a 3D printer to do one or two things. It would have to be a pretty impressive thing for us to do that. So with the pharmaceutical concept again, that patent bargain should hold, because if someone wants to really use 3D printing to be able to infringe, straight up infringement, they're going to have to make a pretty big investment and face the normal wrath of anyone else who's got that patent, which is, I think, currently the case. It's sort of like that moment when piracy or copying of audio cassettes was really, I think, if you look back at the history of the copyright statutes, they were going after the people who were setting up these garages with hundreds of cassette decks and just churning it out like mini factories for public consumption,
mm-hmm.
which is very different than, as you started out asking, you or me or anyone who's tinkering and using these things for rapid prototyping, which arguably the patent system says you can make things so that you can see how they work and improve on them.
Right.
And this enables that, which is the piece that I hope people don't miss as we go forward.
So that's a good question as well. And, of course, now we're getting into the part of the show, Devin, that I call the unfair portion of the show, which is when I start asking questions that are not fair given the time that we have left. So here we go, because we literally have now about 13 minutes. We've started to discuss patents, and I want to contextualize patents in the broader state of the law. As it stands today, and I'm recording again on July 15, 2013, are there any laws anywhere, at least in the United States, let's just leave it there, dealing with 3D printing specifically?
I've not seen anything. It's a great question. It's the sort of thing where I want to double check because, as you point out, it's July 15th, and who knows what's come up in the, in our space. It moves as fast as the technology sometimes, and sometimes it just idles along. I haven't seen anything. I think the more general questions would be people trying to grab pieces of the patent statute, or in fact, copyright, insofar as copyright still covers certain 3D images. I'm sorry, not images. That doesn't make sense. 3D items such as sculpture. And I think trademark will pop up a little because trade dress actually covers, the Coke bottle, for instance, or the ability to use a 3D printer to not only make your object but perhaps etch in a logo could be an issue. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe there's anything specific yet. You haven't seen anything, have you?
I've not. I was, and the context there really is our earlier discussion about guns. I mean, it seems like, already and understandably, law enforcement and others are nervous about the notion that people are going to be able to arm themselves. But as it stands now, you're not aware of any state trying to make it illegal to copy a gun, quote unquote.
Not that I've seen. I believe there's been some federal action on this, and then people who said, well, maybe we should just regulate the gunpowder, which would be sort of like it's what I sometimes offhandedly call the Sudafed moment. Mm-hmm. As someone who has some allergies, I used to like to be able to buy Sudafed, but thanks to the meth problem, I now have to find a pharmacist and say, here's my driver's license, so that if I buy one pack of Sudafed, they know, but if I were buying quite a large number, they might say, well, why is Devin, are his allergies really that bad? So I think people are trying to come up with wrinkles like that, but I've not seen anything gain that much traction yet.
And so that gets us, in the last 10 minutes or so to some of these issues. One thing you said earlier relating to patents, and it also relates to copyrights, is important. There's, as you know and as many listeners know, one of the challenges on the copyright side was how to, and you alluded to it earlier, how to allow technologies to continue to flourish and grow even when they have uses that are illegal. And this is the concept in copyright law, which is known, and also to some degree in patent law, which is known as substantial non-infringing uses. That is, to the extent that a technology is a dual-use technology, to use another phrase, where the technology can be used for reasons that are legal and reasons that are illegal, as long as there are substantial non-infringing, that is, legal uses of the technology, the law says that technology can continue to exist and be used and so forth. 3D printing, of course, runs head-on into that issue. What is your view as regarding patent law and how we can avoid criminalizing 3D printing because of the ability for individuals to copy guns and, as you allude to in the article, drug paraphernalia, sex items, and so forth?
Yeah, it's funny. In the copyright context, the Sony Betamax case, as it's sometimes just referred to, as I remember, it borrows the concept of substantial non-infringing use from patent law.
Right.
And that was for the video cassette recorder, which, if you think about it, while it's capable of substantial non-infringing use in the copyright context, it's not that massive a type of use. It's just a potential for what it does. If you then think about, again, the PC or the 3D printer and the number of things that are non-infringing, I would say if substantial, and I hate to coin, I'm not even going to say it, but you could turn it into a bad noun here, right? But the potential for substantial non-infringing use is greater. it has to be greater, I think, when you start to see what 3D printers can do. So to criminalize them would be, I think, bizarre, A. Mm-hmm. B, I think what will start to happen is there have been some market responses. Some of the websites that are part of the system for 3D printing that provide the software have simply said, well, we won't carry the files that allow you to do certain things. And they're doing this, I think, based mainly on their sense of a personal ethic of some sort, a corporate personal ethic. Just we don't want to be in that business. That doesn't mean it will go away, as you well know, and I'm sure many listeners know. People route around that. They'll share it directly with a peer-to-peer or some other option. But as a general matter, I think the way to make sure this doesn't become criminal or to make sure it doesn't get squashed is, A, recognizing the truly general-purpose nature of the technology, and then, B, perhaps what Gerard and I are talking about in the paper is, even though many people don't like the DMCA or the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that there are some carve-outs in there about the notion of if you're hosting software and you're doing certain things, you won't be liable. So we're trying to find a way to let this area really thrive and not get hammered by lawsuits from either incumbent patent industry people, which I think will happen, just like the copyright industry tried to go after new technology rather than finding ways to live with it, in conjunction with perhaps some outcry from regulators who might make a name for themselves saying, see, I have prevented this from happening, when in fact they're not likely to be able to truly do that. In fact, my bigger fear is you go that route, you push a group that is very willing to be creative and route around the mainstream, and you push them underground, I think you'll get more bad outcomes rather than coming up with what could be a fairly healthy ecosystem of a certain amount of custom, a certain amount of market, and bringing some costs and creativity down, as well as increasing consumer safety if you build it so that the space becomes one where people want to invest and grow rather than see it as a place where their investment will simply get eliminated by the swipe of a legislative pen.
And so that gets us, and you know, we really are in the totally unfair portion of the show, because now I'm going to ask you a question which easily, I could ask this question and walk away and get a sandwich and be back in a half hour. Again, recognizing that Gerard and you are still in the draft stage, and so not holding it to this. But what is your current thinking in terms of what the law should be doing right now? There's always a concern that the law jumps in too soon to regulate in a space that's still developing. Is now the right time for legislators to be doing anything, patent law or otherwise, to regulate 3D printing?
I don't think regulation makes sense. So what we're trying to do is we argue for certain clearer carve-outs in the patent statute. Right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we want to see is some clarification that these aren't going to be seen as components, that the strict liability – oh, sorry, you had asked me to try and do this, so it really is the unfair portion.
Well, yeah, you do have a few minutes, so.
So the basic idea in patent law is that it's strict liability. In other words, you know, folks, if you infringe, you infringe, and that's it. We have you, and so this is something that maybe we can find a way to play with that a little and carve out the space so that people could – have some sort of de facto things. One of the things we're thinking about is the ability to come up with some actual jurisdictional minimums before you could sue someone to create room for the true inventive small scale. While it does eat perhaps at the market a little, again, given that we should really think about these things as trade-offs, that would be pretty good. So those are sort of regulations I think we're going to argue for is. If anything, a little clarity and a little bit of more room to allow 3D printing and makers and tinkerers to be able to play around with the technology and the things that are possible without the fear that they're going to be instantly sued. And that should also help investment in the area. I think it was Michael Carrier has a nice paper where he used a qualitative method and he interviewed venture capitalists and others, and they really said, look, we would have loved to invested in more interesting ways for music to be delivered and have a market there. But once the Napster and the other suits came on, they realized their investment could just get hammered because it seemed not that it was illegal, but that it was actually more in flux and so unstable that they just couldn't tell which way it's going to break each time. So we're trying to figure out ways to get to that. On the other hand, for the upper end things, if someone really needs to regulate certain inputs that are so unique, right? So the chemicals, again, are a great example. Gunpowder is another good example, because how many people need whatever the current inputs to gunpowder are? Probably not many. Then again, if it's really based on fertilizer, you got a problem. But with many other things, you can't do that. You know, plastics, to really say, oh, I think you're buying too much plastic, seems a little wrong, or metals. These are general purpose commodities. So I think the other piece that will happen is if you come up with regulation to protect the people who are sharing the files and make sure the hardware makers don't get into trouble and that there's real space here, is that you could see a really nifty market similar to Google Play or iTunes or Amazon, where people are in fact saying, wow, I want to make my own Lego or Barbie with my kid and design it. And they say, great, we'll give you the designs. We'll even send you the plastic you need to make sure that it lives up to a whole bunch of other standards, because you probably don't want the plastic being toxic, or that, you know, the little costume or whatever you made is all of a sudden flammable and your child is now writhing in pain, right? So that would be, I think, a really great outcome, not writhing in pain, but that you have branded makers, big companies realizing, wait a minute, maybe I can expand my market so that so many more people are buying it directly from me that I'm still making a lot of money and I'm doing what I do best, which is designing stuff and coming up with the latest ideas and creating a way for my customers and fans to engage with my product, evolve my product, and heck, some of them might even say, I think Lego might have flirted with, if you send them a really cool design, not only will they make it for you, though I believe it's kind of expensive when you do it that way, but they might try and sell it as an item. Now, if they're being really smart, I think they would say, you know, designed by Dave, and you get a small percentage for that. All of a sudden, they've got, you know, outsourced some creation. You have an incentive to play with it. It's branded, and other people are buying it, and there's some really nifty things that could come out of that. But if you regulate it to the point of slowing it all down because you're not sure about it, most likely what you're going to do is protect incumbents and not really get all this other creativity, which I don't think makes much sense.
Yeah, and we're chatting with Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law and KZSU-FM and Hearsay Culture. You know, Devin, I mean, you know, and as we close here, you know, my hope is because I do firmly believe that, you know, regardless of market forces and other ways that, you know, that we could attempt to address, you know, the boundaries of 3D printing, that like every other area, our legislators will ultimately not be able to keep their hands off of it, even if the, you know, current political stalemates at all levels of government make that go more slowly. You know, one other issue, which I'm not really asking about because it's not something you discuss in your paper, and it's not it's a little bit out of the range of what we talked about today. But one thing that I've thought about, and almost one of my first reactions to hearing about 3D printing, is the displacement of labor, and the notion that that as hard as it is already for individuals to who are in a lower skill set to you know, find employment, now if we're going to have the potential for larger scale 3D printing that like the assembly line did 100 years ago, 3D printing could also make it even more difficult for people to find jobs. And I'm not really asking you that question. I'm really more throwing it out there as something I've thought about, and something that you know, I think is another issue here. So Devin, let me ask you this last question. So with regard to the current draft, the disruptive power of 3D, three-dimensional printing that you're writing with Gerard Magliocca at Indiana Law, and I'm not going to hold you to a date, but just for listeners that are wondering, do you have a time range when you would expect that there will be a published article, or at least something that those who want to follow up on your work and read your work can look for?
Yeah, absolutely. And quickly, you're 100% right about the labor question. It's the other reason I got interested in this space, is robotics and all of this have really shifted what's going on. As far as the timeline, we're going to have a draft. We're shooting for posting it probably somewhere in later August or September, there's it looks like we're going to be part of a symposium at Georgetown Law Journal on disruptive technology. So we're pretty excited for that to happen. And so we're moving forward to be hopefully within the next somewhere 6 to 8 weeks maximum, have a decent draft up. And we'll be hoping to get feedback as we put it out there and see what else we need to tweak, for instance, the gunpowder insight. But it's been a lot of fun working with Gerard, who's a co-blogger of mine at Concurring Opinions, and it's hard to keep up with this space as it moves so fast. So one reason for us to be faster on getting it done is we can kind of, as you did, say, well, as of today, this is what we know.
right, exactly. Yeah, that's what it is, one of the benefits. Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law School, the co-author of the draft article, not public yet, The Disruptive Power of Three-Dimensional Printing, that we can look for in a few months, hopefully on SSRN or at the Georgetown Law Review website or other places. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. Of course, I invite you back to continue this discussion because we really are in early stages of our understanding and discussion of 3D printing. But thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to it.
A couple of quick notes. We have some great guests coming up on Hearsay Culture for the remainder of the quarter. Valentin Dander, a PhD candidate at the University of Innsbruck, will be on discussing open government data. Tim Jordan of King's College London on hacking. Professor Michael Rich, my colleague at Elon, on technology and criminal law. Jason Cross of Duke. Ellen Broad, the executive officer of the Australian Digital Alliance. And Professor Phil Napoli of Fordham University on algorithms in media. As always, you have several ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on KZSU-FM Stanford Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific time by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. Or you can get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, by going to the iTunes page for CIS, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 188 shows that we have recorded on Hearsay Culture over the last 7-plus years, as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining us today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.